I didn't hear that say record, but I think it is recorded.
It is. They sent it to me.
How are you, buddy?
I'm good. I'm very good. How are you? It's been great to see you.
I'm trying to think of the last time we spoke to each other or seen each other. I've been following you in various different guises in the clubs that you've joined in recent years, following your career anyway, but I don't think we've actually had a chance to chat for a long time.
No, I think the only time that we've kind of chatted is via Twitter, when we've just kind of touched base, seen if we can try and catch up. Obviously, when I was in Orlando and you moved over, just wasn't meant to be, was it? So
exactly. But I'm glad I got you now, buddy. I'm glad I got you now.
How are you? How's things?
Yeah, I'm all right. I'm good. I'm good. It's been 10 years I've been out here now.
Wow, is it really?
In the US, yes. 10 years, buddy. Wow. Yeah.
How are you finding it?
Just about getting my head around life in a new country, to be fair. I had no idea what it was to move and live on the other side of the world, obviously. It took 4 or 5 years to even understand. But now kind of got my head around it now. So, yeah. Settled back in North Florida and kids are happy. Life's good. So, happy days.
Good. And you're Jacksonville now, right?
Jacksonville, yeah. Yeah, St. Augustine, Jacksonville. Yeah.
I think the furthest north I went was like Daytona.
Oh, yeah, Daytona Beach. Yeah. Absolutely. Brilliant, mate. Brilliant. But look, I got this really long, formal, like, introduction, right? And then I'm going to be super excited to get to talk to you about football and everything, and obviously everything you're doing and everything else. So I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to any of those, but I don't really know what I'm doing. I'm just kind of trying to give some strength and support to players and coaches coming up, and, you know, just authentic conversations with amazing people. That's why you're here.
Nice.
Yeah. All right, let me give it my best present a try, and we'll give this a go. It's times like this I realise I can't write properly, and now I don't even know why I've written down. But I'm gonna go for it. Welcome to this episode of the Pro Player Podcast. I'm absolutely delighted to be joined today by a very special player. 234 games, 23 goals. Clubs like Lincoln City, Leeds United, synonymous with Birmingham City, Notts County, Reading. Later in her career, the Orlando Pride, Atletico Madrid, Manchester United. 2 times under 20 World Cups, Euro 2009 winner under 19s, Euro 2013 with the England Lionesses, World Cups in 2015 and 2019 with England, an FA Cup winner, no less. Over 50 caps as a Lioness for England. This is where our lives intersected. But I speak today to a player who I consider not just to be a top professional, but also someone who is one of the most conscientious, studious, unwavering professionals I've ever had the privilege to work with. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome you today. Jade Moore is on the podcast.
Hi, Goffy. That was an unbelievable introduction. Wow. That was I haven't had a recap through my career like that in a long time.
There you go, buddy. There you go. You have literally been there and done it. And my mum used to say, been there, done it, worn the T-shirt. And you have done it all. I'm really pleased you're here today. And I know you're kind of back in your second spell at Birmingham at the moment. And obviously, as I said, they're synonymous with Birmingham. And you know, you've played all around the world. You've played at the highest level. What we wanted to do on this platform was bring top professionals like you right into the heart of the listener, so they can kind of get an insight into not only what it takes to get there, Jade, but what it takes to stay there. And it's not an easy road, is it? It's all great days and wonderful social media posts, but you know, even just reading off the tournaments you've attended there, like the experience, insight you have, is second to none. So without further ado, I'll just shut up and get out of the way. We'd love to hear from you in what life is really like as a professional footballer.
Wow, where do I start? Obviously, I think for me, my career has obviously been an interesting one, because when I sort of started to play football, it wasn't what it is today. So obviously, when you start to say the teams when I started, when I have a little flashback to those times, it is nowhere near, you know, what I've just watched on TV with the Lionesses now, Ireland-Sweden game that I've just seen. Like, you know, it's come a long, long way. So I think obviously my career started as what I would just class as a hobby. I loved the game. I was good at playing football. It wasn't something that every girl was doing at my age. But I obviously loved it that much and enjoyed it, and it was something that I wanted to do. And then obviously I've really been fortunate enough to obviously witness the growth of the game throughout that. And now at the back end of my career, kind of enjoy almost the projection that it's been on, and obviously trying to hold on to get a little bit of fruits of the labour. But you know, being a footballer, it comes with its challenges. And I think the biggest thing is it's about resilience. I know that word gets branded around a lot, but I think without it, you don't make it. And if you don't make it, it's going to try and chop you down at some point when you do make it. So it's about how you pick yourself up and go again. And I think that's been the biggest thing when I look back on my career is if you have no resilience, you know, it's going to eat you up and spit you back out.
I want to talk to you about that for sure. That I think that's something that both players and coaches will resonate with, that resilience. You're being very modest there in terms of describing your own career, but as someone who's been paid by the Football Association to go out and watch you play football and scout you and look at your game, I would say that you, especially now, I'm excited to hear stories about now you kind of being at Birmingham now and really reliving or living a game where you're testing your limits even now and trying things that you perhaps haven't been synonymous with in the past and having great success doing these things and maybe a freedom in your latter years to do things that you might not have done before. And I'm seeing this around you at the moment. I'm excited by this because I always felt you had those strings to your bow. You certainly showed that in the time I was with you. But is that a thing? Are you kind of in your second spell here and you feel at home and you're trying other stuff and doing things you haven't done before?
I think that's, do you know what? I think it's great because obviously you witnessed me when I was at a point in my career where I was kind of in that England setup to do a job and be a disciplined player. And, you know, if someone asks me to do a job, I will do it and I will do it to the 100th tee. Like, tell me how, you know, how high to jump, I'll jump. That I'm that type of player. And I think what when I do look back and I think how much more could I have given from a midfield role of not just being this defensive holding midfielder? I think this year of the one that I've just had, a lot's changed in my life, and I just thought I might not play. You know, I've come off the back of injuries as well, so I kind of had this kind of a new way of looking at my game of football and saying, you know, if I don't try things now, if I don't do it, if I don't play with an element of freedom, I'm going to look back on my career and be like, why not? Why did I allow, you know, the demands of the game in a certain position to stop kind of the love for the game? And that's what I think's kind of come back this last year at Birmingham is I kind of released the shackles. I kind of took away the, you know, if I'm not in this position, the team's going to suffer. Because I think that's what was quite, you know, I think I held that quite heavy, that burden on me in a lot of teams, probably from being like the age of maybe 26. To maybe even a little bit before 20, maybe 24 to 28, that kind of, and it was that prime Lioness era as well. And it was like, if you are not in there, if you're not doing that job, if you're not doing that dirty work, the team will suffer. So, and that's kind of, I think, how I felt a lot of times when I was either wearing the England jersey or when I was at Reading, you know, if I didn't do a certain role well, everything else was obviously not going to work out as well. So I think I put a lot of pressure on myself of delivering a certain task without obviously having that freedom and that joy and that love and, you know, being able to express yourself in a different way.
Do you just to pick up on that quickly then, do you feel like that's a freedom that because you are now a superstar Lioness, because you've been to two World Cups, because you've played at the highest level and you are Jade Moore, do you feel like you can do it now, whereas maybe you wouldn't have done that early on in your career? Or do you feel like that's just the nature of coming towards the end of your playing days where you're like you said, do it now, I'll never do it? Do you think it's one or the other or both?
There's probably an element of both, really, I reckon. I think there's probably that freedom of knowing, right, well, I've got the respect around from the girls to do it. So, and also I had moments in especially this season at Birmingham, like if I didn't lead by example of trying to drive the team forward, it was like we was never going to get that sort of momentum shift. And that was a really interesting dynamic like shift for me because obviously a lot of my game's always been about sort of stopping opposition. Yes, starting the attack, but actually there was moments where I tend to just, give it someone else. Whereas this season, it's been like, well, if I don't actually start the attack with like a drive or a dribble, that's where it's obviously broke down. And I think that gave me something different this year to sort of focus on. But I also think that a lot changed this year in my personal life. And I just thought, I didn't care as much. And I know that sounds terrible, but I had no pressure on myself. Like, football wasn't the be all and the end all of what I was kind of delivering day in, day out. There was much bigger things happening. And it became my release again. It became something that I enjoyed doing. And I think that just got the best out of me from like a release of free, like freedom and play a game of football how I think it should be played.
This is an amazing insight. Like, to have someone with your experience, Jade, and played at the level you have for the clubs you have, and internationally like you have, for you to talk about this kind of walk back to yourself and feeling how you feel about the game and how the game takes that away from you, especially for a female player, I find over the last decade, me working in female football, there'll be a lot of people listening to us today, young players, aspiring players who are stuck in between that rock and a hard place. They have to do obviously what they think they need to do to progress, to get a college scholarship, to play, to get in a professional team, whatever it might be. But the power and the amount of times I hear this about coming back to what is in your heart, and that's not to be disrespectful to any game plan or any coach, like you followed the game plan, you delivered what the coaches want. But this power that you're talking about now, this is something I'd love to touch on and share with all of our listeners and all of the coaches who listen to us. We have coaches aspiring to be in the game, but also people in the game. Why is this power so important for a female player to get the best out of them, do you think? What do you say to that?
I guess the question is, when you go through the years of playing football or the years of being an elite sport or as a manager or a coach, you always get asked, like, what's your why? And I think I don't really think I ever really understood what my why was before, if that makes sense. I think I was just like, why do, well, I've always done it. It's been something that I've always done. And I think that's difficult territory, I think, when you've always done something. Because you just can't not go in like in the motions with it, but you kind of get stuck in that cycle of that routine of being like, here I am, this is what I do, this is what I'm good at. And I think when I look back now in my journey, I had a spell where I was super professional, super diligent on it, but I knew that we went through super strengths, didn't it? You think he was a part of the Lionesses at that point, didn't we? And we went through what we called our super strengths, and it was about honing in on what you was really good at and what no one could kind of take away from you. And I think that's what I did in that era. But what I probably didn't do is, or what I neglected was the other sides, the bits that could take it another level. Add that 10% on, or add that 20% on, and just keep building. And I probably got to a point in that sort of maybe 5 year spell where it maybe got a little bit stale. Do you know what I mean? What I was delivering, it was easy in the end. It became quite easy what I was delivering. So I was never really getting tested, whether that's from a coach, like where coaches wasn't really going, go on, we can get a little bit more out of you. I think we can get a little bit more out of you here. It's actually been, and what you talk about the power is, it's actually, I think this last year or a year and a half, I took the power back. Like I took it back for myself and I said, well, I'm not doing this training and I'm not doing that training. I've done all of this for so many years now and it's not helping me. So I took the power back and I went, I'm going to start doing this type of training because this is what I believe in. I'm going to start doing this type of work because that's what I believe in. And whether you call it a coincidence, whether you call it, the right type of method for me, it all just kind of come together nicely, yeah, at the right time. So I think I look back now and I go, oh God, imagine if I was doing this sort of stuff that I'm doing now when I was at that point. But it's really hard to not look back on it and think that, but try and be really positive about where you're at in your journey.
It's just great insight again, isn't it? I see this week on the internet, in the out there in the world, that Anthony Gordon is at Newcastle and he's done an interview with Gary Neville or someone, and he's like, yeah, I just don't go in the gym. I just don't do it. Like, it's not for me. And I don't think that was a thing you could have said 10 years ago. I think you would have been told, of course it's for you. Like, be quiet. Like, get on with it. And it's great that players are getting to this point now where they know themselves so well. They know their bodies. They know their game. Obviously, a lot of players are qualified coaches now as well. Probably the case maybe 20 years ago or 30 years ago. So I think like this move towards the player being central in a collaborative sense has to be a good one, doesn't it? I hope that's the future of the industry.
Yeah, I do think it's how you manage that, and I think it's how you the collaboration word is key, I think, because if you know, I would have come into Birmingham this year and gone, I don't do that, I don't do this, and I don't do that. That would have got the, you know, instant, maybe not, because like you say, I've got the wealth of experience that comes along with it. However, there's a way of kind of trying to work with people to get the best out of you, and I think that's where you've got to obviously know how to work, not necessarily work people, but how to communicate and how to work collaboratively is hugely important. I think that's something that this year's taught me as well, is trying to get people on board with what you're doing, because actually I look at the work that it's done with me and how much I think I've not necessarily progressed, but how much better efficient, like how I'm moving much more efficiently. I'm like, if you can get the whole girls doing that and you get the younger girls doing it from a younger age, you know, the world's their oyster, basically. So it's almost like I have actually gone in this year and tried to educate as well as sort of demonstrate what I'm doing. And I think the scariest thing is for me is I don't like to kind of blow a trumpet on a certain style or a method of training or whatever unless it's at unless I've given it the time. So I didn't. Everyone was like, "What are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing?" I'm like, "All right, listen. I'm just doing this work. I'm seeing if it helps me. I'm about 8 months in at the moment." Then it got to about I'm a year in, and everyone was a bit more like, "Oh, what are you doing?" Like a bit more intrigued. Then I'm like, "Right, okay, I'm a year and 3, 4, 5 months in now." I'm like, "Now I can start to sell it a little bit because I've got the evidence." Do you know what I mean? Behind what I'm doing, and I think
The
that's
performances, yeah.
and that's the performances as well, yeah.
I know you a little bit. I've been very fortunate to spend a little bit of time in your company, number of years or whatever, but I know that this side is important to you as well. I can feel it that like you've never just been about you, Jade. You've never just been about yourself. You were never just about you when you played for England while I was there, but you're also someone who doesn't need a fanfare, doesn't need people to know what they're doing, doesn't need to be like front and center. You just value the work. You value the collaboration. You value the mentorship. You value bringing other people with you. Is that something you had from a young age? Where you said that you learned your why as you got older, but these core values that are obviously important to you. Were you in touch with those core values as a teenager? Like, were you aware of that in your younger life, or is that something that came later?
I don't know really. I think, do you know, when I look back, I think I've always had a group of friends, whether there was, you know, two or three of us or four or five of us, not huge amounts of friends, but always a nice small knit. And I've kept those friends everywhere, like, and I've just built them. So all of my good friends are still my good friends, even from being at school to going through university. I've got friends from going through England setups. Like, as I've kind of built my life, I've gained a friendship sort of pool that's grown with me. So when you ask me that question, like, is it something that probably I've had? I think probably, yeah, it's probably been something that I've always had, but never really looked at in that way. But you're right, like, I think I never was interested in like individual sports. I always liked the fact that you had to work together to be part of a team, something bigger than yourself. And I think that's always been something that even, you know, quick people ask you, well, what other sport would you do if you didn't play football? And I'm like, rugby. Like something that's team orientated again. Do you know what I mean? Got a good I think social's always been huge. That's what I'm trying to touch on. I think the social side of the sport has always been a big factor for me. And I always played above my age when I grew up. So I was always kind of communicating or dealing with or going out with like older girls, older women. From the age of being 14, I was at senior football. So I think that's probably shaped my journey a lot and shaped how I am in a sort of a group setting.
It's fascinating because not everybody is like that, and especially nowadays, players are under major pressure to build their own brand and to be their own, biggest champion. And I get there's huge benefits to that as well. You know, we know about the struggles that maybe some players in your generation had, having to do other stuff on the side maybe before it became professional or whatever it was, right? But I'm glad we are where we are now, but I do think as well there's a resolution and there's a strength in the way you're talking about still in 2024 playing for something bigger than just yourself and just your cap or whatever it might be. I don't know if Instagram and social media and everything else portrays that very well in the real world. And there's a dichotomy there, isn't there?
There is, yeah, there is. It's a difficult, I think the actual, and I'm really fortunate. I think that's when I look back on a lot. I had a really interesting conversation maybe a year or two back, sat at a table. I think it was away in Malta with the Man United girls, and Les and Toonie literally turned around to me and Rach Williams at the time, and they were like, "Are you jealous of like where the game's at?" Like, and I was like, "It's a great question." I was like, "Absolutely not." I was like, "I'm happy for you guys." I was like, "To where it is, this is what you're gonna kind of reap the rewards from," I says, "but I would not take away the learning, the life lessons, the life skills, my journey for nothing, for no love or no money." Like, absolutely not. I was like, because it's been too good. Do you know what I mean? It's been too good to kind of turn down. And I'm like, and I'm looking at you lot now and I'm like, you're under so much pressure. I was like, do you know what I mean? The image that you're trying to portray has to be a certain way. You struggle to go to the shops these days. And you know, I enjoy holidays, I enjoy freedom, and I enjoy privacy. So all of those things from a personal point of view, I'm like, I'd have to substitute all of that for something completely different. And I'm like, I'm not about that really for me.
No, absolutely great. I mean, what a conversation to be around the table on. You and Rachel Williams, the experience you would have had and the ways you would have seen it. And obviously, as you say there, the younger players coming through now and a different version for them. But it's so fascinating because to be in women's football, and I've learned this, this is the respect I pay to the game. To be in women's football is to stand on the shoulders of those who come before. And everybody in it understands that concept, right? We wouldn't have been able to do anything of what we did during that period of time if it hadn't been for the pioneers of, the decades before, who played under bans, who played when they weren't supported, who played in men's kit that was three times too big, and everything else that they did. And even going back even further than that, when there was no one knew what was going on, really. There were people pioneering out there trying to push the game forward. And in that period, as you say there, between kind of 2012, the Olympics, onto 2018, 2019, that period there was a very special period of putting the bricks in place to allow, I think, the game to be where it is today. And it for Ella Toon to turn around to someone like you who was there in the center of it, ask you that question, that's really important. That's something that's going to go down in the fabric of women's football, like that period of time, isn't it?
I think it's really hard for them to understand the journey that we've been through as well, because they look at it now and they're like, it's always been like this for them. Whereas obviously we're from a completely different generation where we paid to play. We was playing on park pitches, we had, was playing with girls that had, been out the night before. It was at that level. It was a hobby. It was just something that we all did because we enjoyed the game. Whereas, we're at a table on in Malta on a, I think it was in Malta, it was an away trip somewhere. I was in like a really nice fancy hotel. I mean, probably at pre-match or at dinner, I was getting food and fed. It's just a crazy journey to obviously look back on and be like, the reality of it, most people now, I think if you ask that question to the kids now, they would say, I'll snap your hand off for it to be to step into it now. Whereas I wouldn't, I don't like, I think I've learned far too much from my journey. From an off the game perspective to ever warrant, what life or, the career that you potentially could have now at this point in time, it's a much more pressurized environment as well. So I think you lose that enjoyment from the game. It's a job now. It's a job, it's a career path. It was never a career path for me. It was just, do you like playing football? Yes. Well, go and do it then. Or you get a little bit of money. Brilliant. That'll pay for the nights out. Then you get a little bit of recognition and you're like, oh, actually, I'm all right. I enjoy this. I like that. I like the pressure. I like playing for my country. And then you get to a point where you're like, the crossroads come of being like, okay, do you want to do this actually professionally in loose inverted, sort of commas that this is something that you can do on the side of a career? And that's where you've got to be really dedicated. And that's what I think there's a difference with when we obviously grew up for that international setup. You had to ask yourself, do you want it? But how much do you want it? Because you've got to do something else on top of it to obviously substitute it and sit side by side.
I've talked to a lot of players in that era about it, and like we had Kath Morgan on, who is kind of your counterpart in the Welsh team, and she's played 50, 60 times for Wales, and she came up through that just a little bit before you, and she was telling us all about like the sacrifice you have to make. And I kind of came up in my young coaching career watching Kath as a player, trying to forge her way and stay hydrated and train on her own and do all this kind of stuff. So she's kind of just behind you, maybe 5 or 6 or 7 years. But it's a really interesting facet for me in terms of what you talk about away from the game and how much you appreciate what you've learned as a human being, right? And I know you do a bunch of other stuff away from football, and you can talk to us a little bit about that as well, hopefully. But it is something more than kicking the ball around as well, isn't it? It is. And I don't know what your future plans are when you kind of come to the end of your career, whether you will go into coaching or whatever you want to do, but I've always felt you had something to offer in terms of that spectrum as well. So you talk to us a little bit about that. What do you think it's given you on the off the field side, that career?
So a lot. I think a lot. I think team sport in general. I think even if I look at it now and if I was to have a kid tomorrow, would I put my kid in team sport? Absolutely. Just for the lessons, I think, and the way of being able to handle yourself in a team environment, the communication that you have to be able to do, being taken out of your comfort zones, doing things when you don't necessarily want to do things, trying to obviously sacrifice the sacrifices that come along with obviously being an elite athlete. Is huge, and I think that's a really tough skill to learn. Being able to say no to things like boundaries and all of that stuff when you're growing up, when you're sort of going through your adolescent years, when obviously everyone else is doing their own thing, and you're the one that goes, I can't do that because obviously I've got a game tomorrow or I've got training to do. Like being able to have a focus, I think, and stick to it and have that discipline is a really good life lesson to learn when you're in those developmental years. Because I think when obviously you get older and life happens, if you don't have those key sort of foundations put in place, it's easy to just be like, whatever, I'll do it tomorrow. And tomorrow never comes, does it, with anything? So I think those things that I think the game off the pitch has given me is I find out now I'm a lot older, I like structure, I like routine, I don't like uncertainty. What I like to call it is institutionalized, which I think is, which what happens if you've spent the last 28, 29 years of your life being wrapped up in an association that tells you when you have to eat and when you have to breathe and when you have to train and et cetera, et cetera. But I think probably the biggest things that I look back of like what it's given me is understanding myself on another level of like that sort of thing of being like, okay, well, I know it sounds daft, but yesterday I was in a bit of a terrible mood. And I was like, obviously from a female perspective, I was like, okay, it must be around time of the month, et cetera. I was like, I haven't trained for a couple of days. I was like, I need to go out and run. I just need to go and give myself a little bit of a boost somewhere. And I'm like, that's one of the first things that I noticed. I'm like, I haven't trained for a few days, so that'll give me that little kick already. I need to get some work done. I need to get the body moving. So I just think an understanding of me as a person and as a human, like I can't thank the game enough for giving me that.
That's amazing insight, isn't it? And there'd be lots of people listening to us thinking, yeah, you're right. You start to get to know yourself as you get older, but you kind of fall into that in the real world, don't you? You make so many mistakes and go down so many wrong paths that you could be into your 30s or 40s before you start to understand yourself. And you're right, those lessons you can pick up through elite sport and through the development process going into it.
Well, it's
We have a lot of
reflection,
us.
isn't it, that you're getting asked to do all the time? It's the reflection piece, I think, that you get asked to do as an athlete is like, okay, did you play well today? Could you have done better? Did you train well today? Did you give your all? Like those questions that you're constantly probably being asked all the time throughout your career, you start to reflect daily without even
Without
realizing.
thinking.
So it's almost like,
Without thinking.
what haven't I done today? What haven't I done? What haven't I done to put me in the best place? That, okay, well, I can do something about it. And I think that's been one of the things as well football's given me is solution based. I went through a time with, I think, the career that I went on, it was like, don't come to, like, the managers I had, don't come to me with excuses, don't come to me with problems, come to me with solutions. And I think that was kind of the era that I grew up in the women's game of, okay, let's fix things, let's make it better.
Again, fascinating insight. How you take that core theme, and it's so deep rooted that it becomes part of you. It becomes who you are, not just as a footballer. But then that can obviously relate to a game plan or relate to a DNA, if you like, if you want to go even further to a philosophy of a club, you know, like Birmingham or whatever. We had our first ever episode. We had someone you know very well, Remy Allen, who was on our first ever episode of the podcast. And that team I go back to and think about with you and Remy. And, you know, we were talking about Christy Lynette, Karen Carney, you know, these players. It was an unbelievable team, amazing team. And we talk about with Remy in the first episode about the times you had and the team you had there. And she was talking about the same kind of thing, about like how it wasn't just the football. And sometimes it was like difficult circumstances, but it was the group and the people and the fact that you all got together and said, this is something we're going to do, you know, for ourselves and for everyone and for the fans. But maybe that's something you could touch on quickly, because Remy talked about it in the first episode we did, about how special that group of players was.
Yeah, the team at Birmingham was pretty special. I think when I look back at that era, that was probably up there with one of the best. I think I was there 6 years. I think for four of those years was almost, if I'm going to reflect and say, when was the best time that you had playing football?
You can say that.
On and off the pitch, you know, everything that was going on, I would probably say those four first years at Birmingham. We had an unbelievable group. We had such a mix of experience. So we had, like, you know, your Rachel units there, your Kaz Carneys, your Laura Bassetts, your sort of you've been there, done it type players. Then you had that sort of middle core that I put myself in of, you know, aspiring, knocking on the door now, but knocking on the door in a different way of being like, well, these kids are good, they're fit, they're physical, they can run all day long, and they can do it technically as well. So it was almost like we had that, and then we had the young ones as well. That was not so young that obviously they couldn't get involved in obviously the culture side of stuff, but enough to kind of bridge the gap of keeping it fun.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of dynamic of the players that we had, it wasn't all superstars again. We was just good. We was efficient. We knew what we was doing. We could get told what to do and deliver it. And then what I will say on that is we've had a really good social life.
Yeah.
So the togetherness that came along with that team wasn't just made on the pitch. It was made off the pitch. We spent a lot of hours together. We obviously didn't have the greatest of resources then, but we never allowed it to be an excuse. And I think that was kind of, we was in that era of where, you know, we was fighting with Arsenal year in, year out. And Arsenal was Arsenal. There was the pinnacle of women's football. You know, they turned up.
The Arsenal.
Yeah. They had the nice kit. They came with a nice bus. You know, they had everything. Yeah. They had their own Arsenal water bottles.
Yeah.
Us, like, at Birmingham, was literally, we used to call ourselves Raggy Ass Rovers.
Rovers.
Yeah, the Raggy Ass Rovers, that's what we called us. Because that's what we were. We had an unbranded tracksuit the first year, like, because we didn't have the money. And what the managers did at the time is they found kind of the niche of using what we didn't have to fuel our sort of culture. And we loved it, we bought into it, and there was no excuses given. So then when we was playing the Arsenal, it was almost like, yeah, we'll beat Arsenal because we're Raggy Ass Rovers and they're Arsenal. Yeah. Like, how terrible is it going to be when Arsenal get beat by us? And, you know, when we all thrived in that sort of that it's the underdog mentality. And I think then that was something that I then loved. I loved that part about Birmingham. I loved that part about any. That's why then I ended up going to like a Reading.
Yeah.
That's where I kind of felt like I was comfortable, you know, trying to knock the top off the pedestals, trying to fight tooth and nail week in, week out. And that was probably the era. That's what I put down to that kind of being really disciplined and knowing that, you know, if you're not, basically you play a game in those teams trying to not make a mistake.
Yeah.
Because if you make a mistake, you concede a goal.
1-0. 1-0. Yeah.
1-0. And then the game's really, you know, pretty much done. So, you know, there's a lot of pressure. So when I look back now and I go, you know, I probably played 4 or 5 years of really heavily pressurized games, but that probably wasn't necessarily from the coaches. That was probably more my own pressure.
From the players. I remember at that time being at Boreham Wood, watching a Birmingham Arsenal game, and Karen's on the one side and Kelly Smith's on the other. And for 25 minutes, I lost myself. I completely lost myself. I was watching one pick the ball up, do something amazing, and the other would pick the ball up, and it was like a Olympic, fencing match, right? And
Yeah.
obviously everybody around them is doing their thing, right? And it was such a high level, and I'll never forget this. For got to be 27, 28 minutes, the two of them just, right, here we go, and then the other one, and then the other one, and it was just, the time flew by. You've just transported me back to that time, because it was such a high level between those two teams. And you're quite right, two completely contrasting styles, and Karen being kind of the, the wizard on the one side, and Kelly Smith being Kelly Smith on the Arsenal side. I'll never forget that. I'll never forget that match. I'll never forget that day, just being blown away by how two players can put a team on their back, and off they go, when everything around them is still functioning at such a high level as well. That was football for me.
Yeah, one nice era to be a part of.
Oh, it was amazing. It was amazing. Yeah, just to kind of sign this section off, really, you talked at the start there about the resolution it takes, and the grit and the determination, the resilience especially, I think you said, which was fantastic. For those listening to us today who perhaps that's something that they think about and go, well, okay, but if I'm pushed too far, I don't really want to be pushed out of my comfort zone. How do you develop this grit? How do you develop this resilience? Do you have to just go through really tough times, or is there strategies and different ways you can use where you can develop this strength? And then this applies to coaches going through trying to be aspiring into the game, or players, or even, in the world of work and industry in the real world, which I know you have some knowledge of as well. How do you develop resilience and grit to be a top performer?
That's a great question, and probably not a question I can answer, because I think it's probably an individual thing. I think obviously everyone's faced with their own challenges. I think it's how you deal with it. And I think the only way that really, when I look back now and I think about that word and I think about the kind of the tough times that I've gone through, how did I get through, how did I get through it, or what was kind of the mentality piece that I had to put tag along with it? And a lot of it was about being optimistic. I think, that is something that I would say about myself. Even when I'm on my lowest and negative days, I'll still find there's moments to be either grateful for, or there's light at the end of the tunnel. And I think that's the hardest, probably the hardest part. It depends, again, I do think it depends on your personality. Because if you're a very heavily negative drawn person, that's your default, it's really hard to find the positives out of things. But I think that's where you've got to challenge yourself more than anything. You've got to try and find something to either be grateful for, or what can be better, or what have you got to do just to kind of put that next foot in front of the other. Because I think that's the biggest thing. I think when you look at sort of the hard times, or where grit and resilience, those things don't, for me, those things don't, they don't happen, and you don't grab hold of them, and you don't go, oh, this is a moment where I'm being resilient. They're two words that I think you look back on something and you go, oh, I was resilient through that stage because I got through it. Or I did show grit in there because I got through it. I got to the other side. And I think process, I like process. So I like to have kind of things in place, whether that's naturally done in my head or whether I like plan things down. I've suffered quite a few injuries in probably the last 4 years of my career. And one of them, I thought, this is not going to end very well, because I wasn't getting to the bottom of it. No one was helping me. And it was a tough time. It was one of those where I was thinking, why is no one listening to me? You know what I mean, like, it's not getting no better, but no one's listening to me. And in the end, I was like, okay, I can either continue circling the drain, or I can do something about it. And I think when I look back, I'm like, okay, a lot of the things that the world of football has taught me is, if you don't do it yourself, no one's going to do it for you. And another kind of snappy catch line that I always got told is, football's a team sport, but it's the most selfish sport you'll ever be a part of. And at that point, I was like, those two things of me being like, okay, well, they're not going to do it for me, and I'm going to have to be selfish. And I think when you are probably the resilience piece of anything, is there has to be a selfish point within it, because of how do you get yourself through, whatever it is that you're faced with at that point in time, with a positive and an optimistic sort of mentality. Because without those two things, I don't think you get through it anyway. And then maybe that looks kind of that why piece again attached to it. And I think once you kind of understand those pieces, you put that next foot in front of the other, and then away you go.
Do the next right thing. Carly's five, and I constantly watch Frozen 2 every single day. And I'm watching Anna Raise from the Mountaintop now singing Do the Next Right Thing. It's absolutely true, isn't it? As small as it could be. I love your point there about looking back on resilience. You're right. I don't know one point in my life where I've stopped in a moment and gone, I'm being resilient here. That's such a great point. Like, it is something you look back on. And by its very nature, going through these things, realizing you've gone through them, rising to the international team, earning 50 caps for your country, traveling the world to World Cups and doing all you've done, it's such an important thing you say. It might not be something you realize in the moment, but it's something you do and it's something you look back on. Phenomenal. We take a little break here. We're with Lioness Jade Moore. She's with us today on the Pro Player Podcast. When we come back, we're going to talk a lot more about those World Cups that she's played in and the games and the game itself, as we try and help and offer strength and support to our listeners and people for their journey, either aspiring to be in the game or in the industry at the moment. So we're going to take a little break and we'll see you soon. Welcome back. We're here today with Jade Moore, Lioness, 50 caps for a country, double World Cup participant, Atletico Madrid, Orlando Pride, Manchester United, Leeds United as well, interestingly enough. But Jade is with us today. We are delighted to have you here, Jade. We're going to talk a little bit about the game here and everything that she's kind of been through and is still going through in her second spell here at Birmingham, in the Championship, trying to come back into the WSL here with that football club, with that famous football club. Your early part of your career, Jade, you started at Lincoln and Leeds and obviously Notts County, Reading and Birmingham, as you said. And then in the latter part of your year, moving around to Orlando, Atletico Madrid in Spain and coming back to Manchester United. Were those things later on in your career that you wanted to travel and play for other teams? Is that just how the kind of season goes and life goes and you get kind of bought and sold as a player? Talk just a little bit about that transition there in terms of going looking for new challenges.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's really interesting, actually, because when I look at my career from being 21 to, I think I moved out to, when I signed the contract to Orlando, I was either 28 or 29, I can't quite remember. But that 8-year spell was when I was heavily involved in the England setup. And I didn't want to leave England because obviously there was a lot of pressure on being in the country, getting seen week in, week out. You know, if you want to be at the top of your game, you've got all the resources in your country and, you know, this is where you need to be. So I never had an eye on being anywhere else whilst I was, you know, sort of pushing the envelope with my international career. And it literally was that point of my international career had started to take a little bit of a turn because I'd had two surgeries on my ankle. And I'd pushed back to make it for the 2019 France World Cup. And I knew I wasn't in great condition at that point. So it was, and a lot of fresh blood was coming through the setup. And I was like, this is kind of that key point now. If I'm not good to go week in, week out for the England setup, I knew I was getting edged out. And there wasn't really much I could do about it because obviously I'd come back from two ankle surgeries and I'd been rushed back from both of them. So my body did need a little bit of time to readjust. So I kind of had one eye on knowing that from an international perspective, I was going to release or relinquish a little bit of control from that stage of it, because obviously international football comes around every couple of months, knowing that you've got to travel a lot, knowing that you've got to obviously be in England or be somewhere else in Europe or whatever that happens. And it's a lot, it's tiresome. So obviously to go out, and obviously I used to room with Rach Daly on a few England camps, and she used to fly in from Houston, fly back to Houston, be on completely different times in time zones. And I used to be like, I don't know how you do it. So that was always a bit of a put off for me anyway, you know, because obviously you want to turn up to camp and be at your best. And if you wasn't at your best at that point, like, you know, it was unfunctioning really. So credit to the girls that did do that, because obviously I take my hat off to them, because that's a lot. So then at the time of my career, as I start to get older, my international career started to, you know, take a sort of back seat. And at that point I was like, okay, I think I'm ready for a new challenge. I think I'm ready for something else. And then obviously the Orlando deal come on the table. And I was like, this is probably the best time for me to go. It was halfway through the season, the first full season that I would have played back from my ankle up. So I'd started to get some decent minutes under my belt, started to feel a little bit more like myself. I knew that with a new season, a fresh challenge, it was going to obviously motivate me and kick me on to obviously trying to find that little bit of that competitive edge back. Because it's really interesting, I think, for me. That's probably been, if you was to ask a lot of people about me and my career, competitiveness would probably be up there in the top five words I think people would describe me as. And when I come back off of that, the second ankle up, I almost felt like I'd lost that little bit of that competitive edge with everything that I was doing. I think it was because not from being scared, but I think I'd lost that. Probably grit is probably a really good word, because I was like, if I go into a heavy tackle again, what's going to happen? Do you know what I mean? So there was that element of like maybe a lack of trust with my body is probably the best way of putting it. A lack of trust. So then I almost was like, I'm only going to do what I need to do to get by. So that competitive edge had started to dwindle a little bit, and I knew I needed to get it back. And that was probably a club move at that time, a fresh sort of challenge, a new league, a new country. It actually come at the perfect time for me. But obviously then COVID happened. So it actually killed me, completely and utterly killed me. And then COVID happened, and I was training off the back of, because obviously I was like still thinking that I was going to get out to the NWSL, because the NWSL was still obviously going to happen. So I was still training, and I ended up getting this knee injury. It was like freak knee injury. Didn't really know where it come from. I'd gone on a 20-minute run, 20-minute back. That's all I did. Started to get this outside knee pain, and I was like, that doesn't feel great. Then lockdown happened. So actually probably was the perfect time for me. But obviously I had the sort of the thought looming over me that any point I could be jump like put on a plane and I need to go and play in the NWSL, which is the most competitive league in the world physically. I was like, if I can't run, I'm ruined. I'm no good for no one. So I kept trying and trying and trying to train, and it wasn't having it. And then somehow I managed to get it under control, because obviously my background of being a sports therapist, I was like, I think I've got kind of ITB friction syndrome. I spoke to the performance coach that was at Orlando. Shout out to Evie Casagrande, because she's unbelievable. Got a program sorted that I could just do at home, and started to get a little bit of a handle on it. Then I went on holiday. This story will crack you up, to be fair, Goffy. Then I went on holiday in lockdown, was starting to get some decent running under my belt. So the knee had started to settle. I was feeling good. I was feeling fit, because obviously I've managed to run again. And then I couldn't get out to NWSL. Didn't have a visa. That wouldn't happen, because obviously they couldn't get the stuff sorted. And then Orlando Pride didn't make it into the Challenge Cup anyway, because they had a COVID case. So we got completely shut down for the year. So I was like, I really need to go out on loan. So I was in Spain. We landed in Spain on the day, and they pulled back up the 2 week quarantine rule that we had. So when I had to go back home, I would have had to quarantine for 2 weeks. So my agent got on the phone to me when I was out there, and it was like, how do you feel about going to Atletico Madrid? And I was like, yeah, why not? That'll be nice. I'm in Spain at the minute. And they were like, the only problem is if you go home, you can't fly back out for 2 weeks. So how do you feel about just going straight there? And I was like, let's do it. So I flew. Sorry, I
Hold on a
didn't
minute, hold on
fly.
a minute, hold on a minute. You're all inclusive 2 weeks in Alicante, and all of a sudden you got to go to the Atletico Madrid.
And it gets better. So I actually was in a villa in Morbs, because obviously it was COVID, so no, we didn't want to be near anyone. So I got on the train, the Renfe quick train, all the way up to Madrid. 5 days later, I played in the semi was it semi or quarter? Semi, I think it might have been the quarter final Champions League against Barcelona at Bilbao. 90 minutes I played. I've not played since February, I think it was. And this was in August, was it August? July, yeah, July or August.
This is amazing. You play well.
I actually, to be fair, to say I've not kicked a ball, Bezerg not kicked a ball since March, or whenever it was, when we got kicked off the field for trying to train in England, to then go and do a job against Barcelona. Yeah, I was pretty chuffed, to be fair, and not pull up with a knee injury. I was pretty pleased, to say the least.
Mauro, only you would describe playing in the semi-final of the Champions League against Barcelona as doing a job. I'm sure you did
Yeah, I
more
did
than
have
doing
to do a job. We did do a job. To be fair, we did do a job, because we was like, with this whole team had been thrown together. They had something like 7 or 8 COVID cases that couldn't play, and they just was like, go play. I think we only lost
20%
1-0.
possession.
Yeah,
20%
literally,
possession.
it was like true Atletico Madrid versus Barcelona style football.
Defend it, defend it. We took a lot of inspiration during our time at
Oh,
England
we
from the
did, to be
men's side of
fair.
Atletico Madrid, to be fair. So
Yeah,
well
that's
placed,
what it
that's
was
well
like.
placed. So how did that continue? Like, what happened after that? The Atletico
That was it.
side.
I was there. I was there. I didn't go home. I didn't go home until Christmas. I had to another little golden nugget for that is I didn't have a pair of boots. Had to wear Tony Duggan's boots.
That's right, Tony was there. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I had to wear a pair of Tony Duggan's boots. Honestly, you can't write it. Seriously, I don't even know if I had a pair of shin pads. Probably borrowed someone else's shin pads. But I absolutely loved my time there. I did. I had a great time. The girls was unbelievable. I think we had something crazy like 13 different nationalities on that team at that time. We had Brazilians, Colombians, Venezuelans, German. I don't want to miss anyone out, but we had loads, and it was a great bunch of girls. Great bunch of girls. The club was really good. It was probably the most professional club that I've ever been at. I
Really?
walked in, there was like, there's your flat, there's your keys, there's your car. Go.
Cool.
Don't
Play
have to
football.
worry about
Brilliant.
anything. Yeah.
Brilliant. Lo siento, no hablo español. How's your Spanish? Habla español?
Sí, un
Maybe
poco.
not.
I
Maybe.
still, do you know what? It's actually it. I thought I was terrible, but obviously being a Yorkshire girl as well, like the accent's
I want to hear
it's
you
not
speak
too
Spanish now. Come on.
it's not it's
Oh.
not too forgiving. But I picked up so much more because I started doing Spanish lessons. I got a really good friend of mine who does he worked out in Spain for about 8 years, and he's fluent in Spanish now, but he now owns his own Spanish like teaching language business.
Oh, okay,
So I've
yeah.
done a few lessons with him
Right.
when I got back, did a few more a couple of months ago, and I actually know so much Spanish. I'm just not very
I
good at
bet you
speaking
do.
it.
Yeah, I bet you do. Can you listen to it? Can you follow along, like if someone's in conversation?
It's the speed of it. Do you know, I can, if I'm on holiday, I can be like, I know what that word means. I know
Oh,
what
I get
that
it, pick
word
it.
means. Okay, I think that's what they're saying. So I understand so much more than what I can probably
And what you
say.
can say. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think that's the way it goes, isn't it?
It is. It is. I honestly, I'm blown away. I've never seen anything more impressive than a coach who just is 1 minute coaching in this language and then immediately turns to another player, coaches another. It's one thing I've always wished I'd done. I've always said I'm a Spanish learner. I'm terrible. I'd really get on it, but I just think it's so impressive to be able to communicate in different
Yeah,
languages.
it is. It's a definite great life skill. What I did find interesting though is when you go to learn a new language, when for us, and you'll know what I mean by this, and for obviously probably everyone listening, is there's a football language. And what you tend to think is you turn up to another country and you think, oh, you know, I'll just do the translation. You know, like time, for example, you know, tiempo. Well, if you start shouting tiempo on the pitch, like it doesn't transfer, it doesn't translate. And that was
Doesn't mean
something that I
anything.
found really difficult. And that's what I tried to actually, a bit like when I was saying to you about what's the solution, solve something, fix it. I went and spoke to the people in place at Atletico, and I was like, you need to get a Bible done. You know what I mean? Your language, you need to just have it so
Glossary
you
of
can give
terms.
the your terms of what gets said, because you know, I sit here and I listen, I hear the words, and yes, you pick it up, but you'd accelerate that learning twofold within, you know, probably a week or two.
You've actually come across something quite interesting there. I saw Barack Obama speaking about this one day. He was talking about like Basically, he's talking about young people. He does a lot of work still now, even though he's not a president, he's not the president anymore. He's still a president. He's very famous in social media talking about young people, how they can come up to the system and whatever else it might be. And I remember listening to him talk. It's a couple of minutes social media video. I'm sure people can find it out there. But he was kind of saying about just be useful. Look for things to be useful for. You'll always be valuable if you're useful. You know, if you find solutions to things. Much in the same light that what you're saying here, you going to the coaches and saying, look, it would be good if you had this document, is an example of you actually seeing a problem, using your initiative, and then having the confidence to follow it through. And obviously, an environment where you felt you could speak up as well. So all these things matter, but it is such an important thing for people to take initiative and to do that, isn't it? To make things better, to leave it better than what they found it. Not everybody thinks like that, Jay, do they?
No, I think that, yeah, I think the thing is what happens is a lot of people go, oh, someone else will do it. Someone else will do it if, you know, and it's not necessarily hassle, but you've got to tighten, like, you've got to put you've got to wear the, I did a lot of work with a psychologist this last year, back end, maybe last 6 weeks. And I actually
Right.
really love the psychology of culture, team and everything.
Yeah.
And he used to put a term on it about like carrying the bricks. And I think everyone's got bricks.
Yeah.
That's the nature of life. But it's about when you're in a team, it's about sharing the load. And I think that's how we've got to try and get the kids of today to think about that from a perspective of everyone. Yes, you've got bricks to carry. Yes, they've got bricks to carry, but how do I help you carry the bricks? How do you support me?
Wow, what an amazing way to think about it. Yeah, immediately now I've got visions of just young people getting together, whether they're aspiring players or, you know, young people anywhere. Just imagine they talk to each other like that. Imagine it was like, I'm going to help you carry your bricks. Imagine we're going to build this wall together and we're going to carry this together. Wouldn't that be an amazing discourse for the future? What a great way to say it. Love that. I think you've stumbled across something there. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk more football. We've got Jade Moore, Lioness, here with us. We'll see you in a minute. Could be pretending I'm some kind of a TV presenter. I don't know what I'm doing. It's just easier for the editing process. Just tells me when I cut and paste it to edit it, to be honest. Oh my God. All right. All right, welcome back. We're here with Jade Moore, England Lioness. We're talking all things career, what it's like to be a soccer player at the highest level. It's been a fascinating 30 minutes or so far. Can't wait to get into more detail with Jade. Jade, we want to talk to you about those tournaments that we talked about, those World Cups. What's it actually like to stand there and sing the national anthem and represent your country? And you know, obviously, when you do it the first time versus when you do it the 50th time. But lots of listeners to us today will either be aspiring to do that in their own respective countries. As I say, we have listeners from Australia, Europe, the UK, North America. There'll be lots of aspiring players listening to us today that want to know what that moment's like. There'll be lots of coaches that want to work with players at that level as well. You've done it, you've been there, you've lived it. Just share with us a little bit how special it is. What is it like?
I think the best part of answering this question now is being able to look back, reflect, and almost feel the emotion of it. Because I think it's a really nostalgic feeling now, sat here thinking about it, that, you know, it's a really proud moment. It's almost the pinnacle, it's the pinnacle of what you've been achieving. It's like all it's the fruits of your labor. It's everything, you know, the every day that you've put in the extra work, the parts that you've probably hated, and then you look back now and you go, you did all that for that reason, and you managed to obviously experience that. But when you're in it, and when you stood there and you're singing the national anthem, when I go back into that now, looking, you know, I can almost see myself stood there in the lineup doing it. It's just focus. It's complete game mode. It's complete. I've got a job to do. There's nothing else. There's no other distractions. It's just right. Let's hear the whistle. And I think that's when you know that you're a true competitor, or whether you're in it or whatever. Like, this, you're not actually, or you're not really using the emotion of the situation. It's just, this is my job. This is what I'm here to do. Let me go.
That's great insight as well. So that I've heard this described before in the Marines and the SEAL Team 6 and everything else. Like you will. We actually had the Air Force come in one time when I was at Oklahoma and University of Oklahoma, and the Air Force came in. They talked to us about this. You will devolve to the level of your training in a stressful situation or in a high performance environment. You think you rise to the occasion. We like the romanticism of players rising to the occasion, but actually, every human being in that environment devolves to their level of their training, which is why the Marines and everybody else are trained in the way they're trained. And obviously, when it comes to high elite level athletes like you, it's the training you put in, the dedication you put in that you fall back on in that moment. To hear you describing that process happening live is fascinating. And I think we had just before you here, actually, we've released it this week. We had Emma Alsop, I call her Emma Duggan, our performance analyst for England
Oh,
on
did
the
you?
podcast. Yeah,
Wow.
we did.
That'll be a
Just a
good
couple
one to
of
listen to.
it was amazing. It's Emma, right? She's one of the best people in the world and so
Absolutely.
humble, but just such an amazing person, right? And we were talking, she actually brought something up about that era of like we would change quite a lot to play the way we wanted to play against teams, if you remember at the time. Whereas now I think it's very much football is we play our philosophy, we play our way, we don't change for anyone. That's kind of the shift, if you like. And I don't know if I
Yeah.
ever told you this, but in 2015, according to Opta, there was one player ahead of the regain list in the whole of the world, and it was Jade Moore. And it was Jade Moore by 40 or 50 or 60 regains per 90 minutes of a match. I don't know if I ever told you that, but you were officially,
No.
according to Opta, the number one player in the world at recovering the ball in 2015. So I want to share that with you if I never shared that with you at the time. But we built a lot of game plans around that with you and with other players because obviously that was a stat. It was the time when football analytics was it was there, but it wasn't what it is today in terms of stats, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, in 2015, you were by not just by a little, you were by a long shot, double the closest player. I think was a French player, I can't remember, but you were the best regainer of a football in the opposition half as well, which is important in the world at that time. So like I say,
We used to love
when you
setting a
talk,
trap, didn't we?
yeah, we did very very famously on a few occasions as well, and you started all those off. But I think when you're building a game plan like that, certainly from a coaching side of things, to then hear you as a player say, look, nobody's saying disrespect the anthem at all, right? But you want to get the anthem and the ceremony out of the way so you can get on with the job. That's amazing. That's high performance in and of itself, isn't it? In a stadium in front of 30,000, whatever it might be. I imagine that's a huge mindset because that's not an insight I ever got. We might have talked about the game plan. We might have talked about coaching. We might have, I don't know what influence we end up having in the end as coaches. But to have you elite performers there on the start line ready to perform that role, isn't that is what it is, isn't it? You're kind of alluding to it there.
I think the actual, when I look back at the moments of standing and singing the anthem, probably were the calmest part of the whole day for me. Do you know what I mean? It was probably that little bit of that reset of being present, because that was probably the really only time that you could be present, throughout the warm-up. If you're in your own head, you're thinking, oh God, nothing feels great. That don't feel good. Do you know what I mean? So you're trying to get out your own head in the warm-up. So the anthem is probably the only point in the whole of the time of the build-up to the game where you're probably just present and doing what you're doing at that moment, singing the anthem, being there, trying to feel a little bit of, the calmness. Because obviously we haven't got an upbeat anthem either, which I think, we don't have that sort of cheery, that's going to motivate you. We actually have quite a, I wouldn't say therapeutic, but it's quite a calming anthem. So it's probably the only time that really you get the heart rate down is stood there in
Stoic.
an
Let's
England
say
jersey. Yeah, stoic. That's a nice
stoic.
word.
Let's say that.
Yeah.
So look, for all if I can talk to the coaches who are listening now, because you have a lot of obviously coaches in the industry aspiring to be in the industry, one day would love to work with a player at your level, right? All of us coaches, we all think that we have these great game plans and we put all these tactics together and we do these training sessions and everything's brilliant. It's all perfect, right? But as a player, when that anthem finishes and that game starts, obviously, you're prepared. Obviously, you have your instructions. You've worked on a lot of things. But then, as the game starts, can you talk to us about what happens in that first kind of 6 to 8 minutes as you're kind of feeling it all out? I think Mike Tyson said once, everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the face. Like, what's it like from an elite sports woman's point of view to be on that pitch and then trying to carry out those instructions and play that game? What's it like?
Yeah, that's a great question as well, and probably something that I haven't thought too much about. But I think is international. I will say international football for me was a different beast, because I think once that whistle went, I was like, right, boom, focus. I'm here. Do you know what I mean? I've got a job to do, because I did have a job to do. And it was like, okay, where do I need to be? What have I got to do? And there was a lot of pieces that fit the puzzle for me in and around the game, because obviously I wasn't always the player that was on the ball, but I was organizing, I was pulling people in, I was making sure that I was covering and supporting and blocking off certain passing angles. And you know, there was a lot, I think there was a lot of processing having to happen for me. So I think that was where the focus had to be. But when I look at it, when I kind of have a look now and think about where did almost that first, you know, what people say is like, make sure what you do, the first thing that you do is good. So whether it's your first pass, you know, it's a good one, or your first header or your first tackle, leave one on, you know, leave one on someone. And I think that's how I end up sort of managing that first sort of 5 to 10 minutes. It was always like, if we didn't have the ball, go get the ball back. Like, can you go and hit someone, you know, go and leave a mark in the nicest possible way? And can you know, get comfortable and calmness in possession? So can you do your first, you know, can you do your first pass well? But I think what I got to a point in my career is I didn't allow, if it was a negative pass or if it wasn't a great tackle, if it was a bit ill-timed or if something, I didn't allow that to seep in. I just pushed it to one side and said, next one. And I think that was something that when I look back on my career is I was quite hard on myself throughout a game, or quite hard on myself post a game. If I didn't think that I'd done probably 80, 90, probably 90, 95, 98% good, I'd be like, wasn't a great game for me today.
My heart hurts for this stuff. I really does, and I'll tell you for why. Right, I've spent the last 10 years in the women's game, and a little bit in the men's game too. I will say this: I worked in academy football and youth football, youth development football in the men's side mainly. So I saw young men, young people, 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds do this themselves, right? But I see it a lot on the female side, even up to including college level players and professional players, right? Why are we, the royal we, why are we so hard on ourselves as players? Why do we use this discourse that clearly doesn't help? And if I sat down the cold light of day with a you know player and said, look at what you're doing to yourself, look at the self-defeating behaviors you are engaging in, look at the perfectionism you're trying to attain, none of this is going to help you, none of this is even possible, yet you are ingrained in this process from 13 to 25, 27, 28, 29, whatever. And no one can get out of it. Nobody can move away from it. And it seems to be the discourse, especially here in North America, a lot. But my heart hurts, and I want to change this. One of the reasons for this platform and doing this in the first place was this. You've got a background in psychology. You've got a background in this stuff. You just spoke there openly and honestly about you doing that to yourself a little bit and then coming through it. What would you say to those aspiring players and those coaches coaching these aspiring players about that? Like, how can we change the discourse here? We can't continue this way. How do we make it better?
Well, it's mindset, isn't it? I think when I look back on my journey into the game, and when I look back in the youth system of England, if you wasn't the best of the best, and what I mean by that is if you didn't tick all the boxes, or you wasn't a certain, you didn't fit a certain mold, you didn't manage to get through the system very well. So it was almost about being perfect. There was a very, well, they didn't say those words, but they made it very apparent. If you don't do it this way, you won't be here. If you don't do it that way, if you don't listen to us, if you don't get on board, if you don't get on the train, you won't be here. So there's very subliminal, there's, you know, there's a lot of subliminal messages that go, that I think that seeped in throughout my journey of, if you're not perfect, you won't make it. If you're not hard on yourself, you won't make it. If you don't fit the mold, you won't make it. So then you become very switched on to the negative sides of the game. And other, you know, I did a lot of work with, you know, Adam Streeter when we was at England, the psychologist, and he used to sort of frame it to me of being like, okay, but for every one negative, you need two positives. You can be negative, or you can be critical, probably is the best word of saying. You can be critical on yourself because you want to be better. But for every one critical, you have to give yourself two positives. So only way we'll sit down and we'll talk about things like that. And he started to change my process, because he literally, I think one of the first meetings I had with him, he said, give me five negatives And I went, bum, 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 bum. And he went, now give me five positives. And I went, oh. Well, I think. And he went, what do you mean you think? And I was like, well. And he was like, right, well, listen, that's where we've got to start. And that was something that at that point I started to change, and I started to change that kind of the default. And I think that's what that had been ingrained from being a kid going through the system of being like, if you're not perfect, you're never going to make it. And then I got to a point of being able to, okay, I've not done that very well, but what have I done well? Okay, I did that well and did that well. Okay, did that make that bit better, or did that sort of hinder that? Well, actually, if I wouldn't have done that, that wouldn't have. And then you start to almost retrain a habit of always thinking on the negatives and starting to think more positively. And that actually did start to change my game. It started to change how I came away from a game. I wasn't so critical. I wasn't so deflated. I wasn't so like, yeah, but, yeah, but. And also, I've looked back and I'll go back to parents. Parents will always sit their kids in the car and they'll say, you didn't do this very well, you didn't do that very well, you didn't do this very well. I don't know if that still happens in these generations, but I think it definitely did in mine. And I look at that and I'm like, if I had someone going to me, you know, you didn't do that very well, but you did this really well, and you did that really well, and you did that really well, but you know, next week you can work on that and do all of them things again. It'll, do you know what I mean? It just changes the your perspective on things. I just think it maybe is a way or a culture of football that's always been involved in the game of you wasn't good enough, or this wasn't happening, or that wasn't happening. And we're just, I don't know whether it's an English thing, or I don't know whether it's a football soccer problem. But if you can start to ask the kids, I think asking the kids or asking the players, what did they think they did well? And what did they maybe think they could do better? Because they're two completely, you know, different questions. I remember speaking to Toosey once, good old Toosey, and he was
There's
chatting.
quick shout out to Toosey. How good is Toosey, by the way?
Yeah, he's
Geraint
a great
Toosey,
guy.
how good is Toosey? He's one of the best I've ever seen.
And I was doing some work with him. Obviously, when you left, I didn't have a midfield coach anymore in England, did I? So then I got, you know, the second best with Toosey. And I remember being sat there, and we was having a chat, and we was talking about the in possession of a midfielder. You know, and about like stats and all of those things, and he was telling me about his boy, and they were saying, and he was saying that he's in a bit of a negative spiral at the minute because he keeps giving away a few passes, and I said, have you ever thrown it out there to him that the more passes he makes, the higher his percentage chances is of being better? So if he only makes five passes in a game, but he messes up three, I was like, his stats are pretty low. I was like, but if he makes 100 passes, I was like, and he messes up 30, his stats are always going to be different. And I was like, and that's, I think, if someone would have done that to me when I was growing up, coming through that, especially probably through that England era of being like, take more risks, but do it more often. So do more. Do you know what I mean? Be involved in the game at a higher percentage, because even if you make a mistake, the next one or the next one or the next one, the next five may be good. And then you forgot about your mistake.
Amazing insight again. Look, two things here. One quick segue. A fantastic Cody Two story, right? Toosey's boy. Me and Toosey were together at Cardiff City, and Toosey came in the office one day, and I generally mean he's one of the best I've ever seen. I still do look up to this guy, right? And he came in the office one day, and he told me a story about his boy. He said, I was sitting on a sofa the other day, and he's eating a bowl of ice cream, and Cody comes in. He must have been about 11 at the time, and he goes, "Get me involved." That's what he said. Get me involved. And he just started eating ice cream. And I've kept that sentence with me forever. Even like this week, I've said, when I see something exciting, get me involved. Right. And that's my Cody
Yeah,
2 story. That's my Cody 2 story. You got to help me get a hold of Toosey as well. I'll try to get hold of him a few times. We want to get him on the pod at some point. But what you're really touching on there is something so important, right? The idea of more positive to negative, 5 to 1. The way you talk to yourself, you mentioned perspective at the start of the podcast as being so important. But here's the deal. We've got Jade Moore, England Lioness, World Cup participant twice, 50 caps for a country, telling you that this is the best shift you made in your career to take care of yourself, give yourself more grace, and it made you better. This flies in the face now of Hollywood and all the old acronyms and anecdotes about tough love and only the strongest survive and you have to be tough on yourself. This is not like David Goff or just somebody round a campfire saying, be nicer to yourself. This is Jade Moore, right? So this now gives a space for every young player listening to us to actually change the way they talk to themselves. And that is power. That is powerful.
Absolutely. I think, you know, your biggest critic is always going to be yourself. Fact, you know, or maybe your parents, you know, they come hand in hand. But, you know, you're the one that feels it. When you play a game or you play, you're in sport or you're on the side of the coach, you know, you're always going to reflect firstly on what you could have done better. Because there's not just you in a team game. So you're going to be like, okay, where did I let, you know, not necessarily let my teammates down, but where could I have done more? Where could I have helped? What could I have done to help that situation out better? Or how could I have stopped the goal? How could I have been more? And actually, when you start to relinquish, I think, a little bit of that control and just let, I think that's been a big shift this year when I start to speak about this now. I had to let go of control of others around, of being like, okay, I can't control them. I can't control. Yes, I can help them. And this was another nugget from the site guy that I worked with, Steve Sylvester, a little shout out to him. He said, how best can you serve the team? So he used to say to me all the time before I went out, he used to go, Jade, serve the team. Serve the team. And whatever that meant to me and whatever he was kind of the conversation that we'd had maybe, that is what he was saying to me at that point of how do I best serve my teammates? Is that doing my work? Is that looking after me? Is that helping someone else? Is that chatting someone? Serve the team. He says, and when you start to take it off yourself, when you start to stop being like, oh, I have to do that. I have to do this. I have to do that. When you start thinking, I need to serve the team, he's like, you'll run that extra bit more. You'll do that extra something. He was like, because it's not about you, it's about a bigger purpose.
Wow. I mean, again, so simple in one sense, but so intricate and important in another, right? Just flipping that switch. So much pressure again on young players listening to us today. When people see your name on this today, they're going to tune in. They're going to be like, wow, I've got to listen to this, right? And there's a young player out there listening to us now who is now thinking, yeah, I feel under pressure. Yeah, I want to be brilliant. I want to do what Jade's done. I want to play for my country 50 times. I want to go to the World Cup. But if I continue to work on myself, if I continue to develop and I continue to serve my team, you've just created another little bit of space for the pressure to be released a little. And maybe that's what somebody needs to kick on and one day be sat where you are getting interviewed like this, perhaps. I don't know.
Well, it changes your focus. It changes the way that you view a certain moment of the game, because at one point you'd look at it and you go, I should have, or I'm in. But if you're looking at it, how do I help my teammate at that point? And if you do something that's not quite right, but you've got that side piece of saying, but I was helping the team.
Yeah.
Then it's not wrong, is it?
No, it's not wrong. And should have, as a past tense, doesn't matter anymore because it's about what I've got to do next. If I'm engaged in serving the team, what I should have done is irrelevant. What I will do next and what I'm doing now is important. It's such an important idiosyncrasy of language and just the way you think about things. And again, it's great for me to say it or for someone else in a book to write it. But for Jade Moore to say it, with all your success, having been there and done it, this is going to give a space for everybody to really reflect on this. And not just players, Jade, coaches too. We have a lot of coaches, aspiring coaches listening to us today who might be focusing on slightly the wrong things. Maybe they are putting a little bit too much pressure on the mistakes that young players make. Maybe if they sent their players out there to serve the team, which I'm sure they all want as well, they could relax the language a little bit. And no one's saying make it easier, but just help them to handle the demands more, isn't it? That's probably more poignant.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't sort of take, when I look at the season that I've just had, the games that I felt pressure creeping was the games that I felt like the tunnel vision of freedom. happen.
Freedom being,
And I was
yeah.
like, that's really interesting for me at this point in my career, where I'm like, when I put a little bit too much pressure on myself, or when I thought like there was a bigger emphasis on the actual game, I was like, if I'm feeling that, am I giving that away? Am I, is that not the rest of the girls are now feeling, because I'm almost admitting that? And
Yeah.
then is that then where, that little bit of lack of fluidity happened? The games where we was flying, we was free, we was free flowing, we were serving the team. Do you know what I mean? It was
Yeah. Yeah.
high energy, it was loose. The
Yeah.
games where we got a little bit sticky was when the pressure started to happen, or when the game, there was something else attached to the game. And that's what I think is really interesting. And that's where it's, for me, I felt all of those things happen. I just could obviously handle my own emotions, or my own sort of the way that I dealt with it. But I look at the team that I had, and I'm like, we had a very young team. So how do you get that through to the players, of trying to be like freedom focused? And how does, so what he used to say to us is like, serve the team. What does that mean to you? Like, if you can serve the team, if everyone's team focused, team orientated, it's not selfishly driven. So you're not always worried about yourself. But if they're already selfishly driven, and you're trying to change the way that a player is already sort of thinking or defaulted to in a season as well, because this wasn't at the start of the season, this was the back end of the season, it was really hard to kind of navigate when things started to take a turn for the worse, if that makes sense.
Yeah, in the moment, yeah, very difficult to see. I want to come on to the other stuff you're doing. I want to talk about the Heart Foundation stuff and everything, all the important stuff you do off the field as well, and your own practices and everything you do. But to wrap this kind of section up, I just want to put a section in there for the aspiring coaches listening today who will one day want to work with, players at international level, professional level, whatever. Can you talk to them a little bit? What advice would you give them? What's the best things that the coaches in your life have done? What's the things that people should avoid? What advice would you give to aspiring coaches who one day want to be stood face to face with a player like Jade Moore preparing for a World Cup match, say?
I think the way that I sort of look back on the coaches that I've had, and when I've either been at my best for them, or maybe not reached the heights that I probably could have, I think a lot of it goes down to, and maybe this is just a personal thing for me, but if I've felt no worth, I probably haven't delivered the highest of ceilings, if that makes sense. If I've felt not underappreciated, or I think worth's the key word, if I've felt like they've appreciated me, they know what I bring, there's a key, I don't know what the word is, but when you feel valued's probably a
Value,
really good
yeah.
word, about being able to make, and do you know what, that didn't necessarily mean when I was playing week
When
in,
you're
week out
playing.
either. Because what I think a lot of people go is, oh, like, yeah, you're valued because you play. Well, no, there were some teams I was at where I didn't feel valued, but I was playing week in, week out. And that's where I'm like, okay, that's maybe where I didn't reach the levels that I could have, because actually I was always like, whereas in some of the teams, I'm like, God, I pushed the boundaries there
Yeah.
because I was valued. There was a worth attached to me. There was something, they give me more to do. They seen that I needed maybe pushing in a direction of leading by example, or needing to do X, Y, and Z off the pitch, because they knew that I was capable of sort of achieving or pushing the things. So I think communication is huge. And I think honest communication, and then that's and that. Yes, there's going to be times where, people go, oh God, that's a bit too brutal, or it's a bit too this, or, and a lot of people always say, I just want to be told the truth.
Yeah.
There's a way of doing that. Like, for me, there's a way of doing that. I think if you're a really poor communicator, you're going to struggle as being a manager or a coach, because, it's the foundation of coaching, in my opinion. It's a foundation of being able to actually manage people. So communication is huge. I think making your players feel valued and have worth is really important. And actually treating you like a human being, I think, has been one of my biggest things that I look at. And I'm like, a lot of people don't like to treat people differently. They like it to just be like everyone's in a tracksuit, everyone wears the same thing. We're human, we're sorry, not humans, we're robots. Everyone behaves the same, everyone turns up, does the same. But actually, I look back on it now and I'm like, no, people are different.
Where's the individuality?
Everyone's, yeah, everyone's different. Yes, I'm not saying that people need to be treated so, you know, you can have 17 days off this month because you need it. You know, it's within a a confound of what it looks like to be a professional athlete. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to treat you as a human. I'm going to treat you as an individual. I'm going to get to know you. I'm going to find out what makes you tick, and I'm going to find out where I need to push you from a personal perspective. That's only going to make the whole team better. But what I am going to do is I'm going to allow for the individuality of what you bring. And I think once you start to get that in a team, which I think is really, because what I look at with coaches is, especially in the women's game, they don't have enough resources. So they don't have enough staff. They don't have enough manpower. So to get to know every single one of your 20 plus players on a
Difficult.
personal level, to give them worth, to find out what makes them tick, and all of those things that come along with it, that's time consuming. And then when you've got, you know, maybe only a 6 week pre-season to get through, and then you start competitive game, which then your job's on the line, it's a really tricky job to do. Do you know what I mean? I'd like, as a older senior player now, I do not envy any manager or any coach, not at all. I don't, because it's a 24-hour job.
Yeah, it is. That's why it is as well. That's why it is. That's why it never ends. Because there's
Yeah,
always an
and you always
opportunity.
have to be the bad person as well.
There's always an opportunity for a conversation. There's always, and I always found as well, it's in the things you don't say. You know, if you walk past the player
Oh
and
God,
say
yeah.
nothing, like, you know, you're communicating something without, and you might not mean it, but it's something I've thought about a lot, is like, and that's why it takes till 1 o'clock in the morning sometimes, because all the stuff that is not people related that can be pushed gets pushed to the people related stuff. And then eventually the players on camp will go to sleep, go to bed, whatever it is, right? And then the other stuff can start. But it's really interesting you say that, because and again, it was people like Adam who helped me to understand this. It's so important what you do say, it's so important what you don't say, it's so important how you say what you say. And it never turns off. It doesn't matter if it's match day minus four. You can't be somewhere different. We had Jody Taylor on. We've had a couple of other pros on in the other series, and they said the same thing. And it always really kind of upsets me a little bit that one of the things you guys always end up saying is you just want to be treated like a human being. That's really a sad indictment still. I hope that will change. I hope it is changing. I know we have people in the industry listening to us as well. That's got to change. It's certainly changing here in North America with everything we've been through in the league in the last few years. But it's real good insight again into, like, you know, if you're an aspiring coach thinking about this now, it's not just about what you're going to do with your inverted fullbacks. It's not just about how your strikers are going to play. Think about this. Whatever level you're at, whatever you're working, how are you going to be? How are you going to show up in this moment, isn't it? That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I genuinely think, you know, the higher levels you get, the tactics do play a part. But if your players don't like you, they don't buy into you, or it doesn't matter what formation, what tactics you give, it's not going in. It's they're not going to play for you. I listened to a podcast a few years back, and it was about love, believe it or not. And it's, you know, this is probably going to be a bit of a taboo, like when it comes to coaching, but you almost have to make your players love you, because the strap line was, is you love your Xbox or your PlayStation, but if your house is burning down, are you running back in to go and get it?
Yeah, you wouldn't know.
You wouldn't. But if your dog or your cat or your parents or your, you know, your baby or your kid, or that's the difference. And that was basically what they were saying, of like, if you can get your players to love you, they're gonna run, you know, they're gonna run into the burning building for you. And that's the game. That's the analogy based on the performance, of they're gonna go beyond. And that's, I think, you know,
Brilliant.
there's as a it's a bit of a tricky subject to obviously try and work that around. I mean,
No, but I
there's a
totally
there's
get what
a
you're
there's
saying.
a level of respect, and there's a level of family feel that's probably delivered. And I, when I, and when probably Ren was speaking about that Birmingham time, that was what we had.
These are the words and the things that people use to describe the best times in their lives. And coaches often get described in this fashion. I loved playing for him. I loved playing for her. Like it's not something we necessarily say about, our teachers or our doctors. Sometimes teachers, of course, but you're right. It is something in the coaching community and how everybody gets to that point to have that level of influence, I think, is the magic sauce, isn't it? Because you've got to be relevant, and or you can be anything if you're going to work in this game and if you're going to stay in this game, for sure. For sure.
But you've got to be relevant for each player as well. And that's the difficult part, because you might be relevant to five. And that's what I've found throughout my journey is, I've worked for coaches and I'm like, oh, I love them. They're great. And I'll speak to my friend and I'm like, I hate them. I hate them. I hate this. I hate that. I hate this. And I'm like, but really? I really like that. I really like this. No, so you're
It's
never going to please
impossible.
everyone. It is
No,
impossible. But I'm
you see how
like,
difficult
that
it
is
is.
the, yeah, and that's the thing. That's why I don't
All the
envy you
coaches,
guys.
all the coaches listen to us now are going, "See, I told you. See how hard it is. See
Yeah,
how difficult.
I'm
One
clocking
wants a
off.
short meeting, one wants a long meeting, one wants this, one wants one that." I mean, you can't please everybody. But again,
Yeah.
if it was easy, I don't think it would have the lure and the it wouldn't be as visceral. I don't think people would enjoy it as much when it does come off in the process, and obviously the coaching side of things. But brilliant. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to finish off talking about some of this other important stuff and just really sign off and say thank you to Jade for spending this time with us. Welcome back. It's been an amazing bumper episode, well over an hour here with Lioness Jade Moore. Can't believe we've had this much time. Thank you, Jade, for just being here with us. And I'm gonna have to listen back to this one at least 4 or 5 times because there's certain things in here that I'm scribbling down and trying to remember them as you're saying them. But again, such inspiration and such strength that people can take, because that's what this podcast was about. Like, listen to this, gain some strength, gain some insight. Hear right from the superstars exactly what it's like to play and to coach at the highest level and what you're going to need to be able to do for your time when it comes, when you're there and when you're ready to be there. But as I said before in the kind of start of the pod, Jade, you are, and it wasn't just words, you are one of the most conscientious and just strong players on the field and off that I've ever had the privilege of working with. I always got the sense that it was about something bigger for you, and representing your country, I know, was one of the proudest things you've done. But I also want to say that you do this amazing work off the field. You've obviously been heavily involved in, is it the Heart Foundation? You're working with the British Heart Foundation. I know you're doing work around that as
Cardiac
well.
risk in the young.
Cardiac risk. So just can we talk about that a little bit and maybe give you a platform to kind of share that stuff as well, please?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to. So obviously most people, if they know anything about me, will probably already know that I was diagnosed with two holes in my heart, right at a time in my footballing journey when I'd just moved away from home at 16 to go and embark on what was then the Player Development Centre, which was like a feeder system for the England setup. We trained every day, we did gym twice a week, and then we went back to club football at a weekend and played for your club football. So it was like an academy run system. And on the first week of being there, I was screened from a medical screening point of view, which obviously most athletes now get through their insurance and through their club medical schemes. And in that sort of screening process, they actually picked something up right there and then that something wasn't quite right. They wouldn't allow me to train that day, which I was absolutely devastated about, as you can imagine. And I was like, not only was I devastated about not training, I knew I had to go and tell Mo Marley that I couldn't train. And that was a scary thought as well. But obviously, from that process, I ended up finding out that they thought they'd found a hole on the initial scan. I got pushed through for more testing and I ended up finding out that I had two holes actually, not just the one. And if one hole would have been 0.1, so 0.1 mil bigger, so I think I had a 0.5 mil hole and a 0.2. If one of them would have been a 0.1 mil bigger, I would have had an open heart surgery. So I was really fortunate that they could do the procedure just through a vein. They went through a vein because it's obviously easier to heal, a quicker healing route. and they put a device in there that basically covered both of the holes in the septum in the wall of my heart that basically stopped oxygenated blood and deoxygenated the blood getting sort of mixed in. But what they did find out is because obviously I've been training so hard at that point, my heart had started to get slightly irregular on one side. And they basically were saying if that was to obviously have not got picked up and I was still following the route of what was going down from a professional athlete perspective, that they wasn't quite sure whether obviously I would have been one of the many actually that keeps happening that do collapse on the pitch. So I was, you know, my story is a survivor story. So I'm really fortunate to obviously be here today, do the stuff that I love, had the career that I've had in the game, but obviously be an ambassador for the Cardiac Risk in the Young, which is a charity foundation that delivers and goes out and does these routine screening setups anywhere in the UK for anyone to go in drop-in centres, and they're free. So it's a really, really good charity run, because it's a scary stat that 12 kids, I think, under the age of 35, 12 young adults, 12 a week die of a base, yeah, a week pass. And usually if they would have been screened, they would have been able to obviously have a normal, like, live a normal life. And I've been an ambassador for Cry for since, well, since actually I had the surgery, so from 2007. And I've always done bits and pieces, obviously having the career that I've had, our time's limited, and especially with the international career, I don't have a lot of time off. So a lot of the stuff's either been like parliament receptions, going down and doing a few talks and stuff, and just always kind of doing the bare minimum that I've been able to do to obviously keep me involved. But obviously knowing that my career's kind of coming out to the back end, having a little bit more free time this year, knowing that our league was going to finish in April, and a really good friend of mine, the guy that I was speaking to about the Spanish, who's the Spanish teacher, he plays for a British Heart Foundation team. And we've been chatting for years about trying to get a five-a-side team going. And we touched base, I think, in January this year, and we was like, why don't we just try and get an 11v11 game? And then kind of wheels were in motion, and it was a bit of a pipe dream 5 months ago. And they do that. They have like, I think they have like a 3 to 4 month spell where they play quite a lot of games, the British Heart Foundation Football Club. And they were like, it'd be great, we play you. You get your own 11, and we'll try and get it at a really good stadium. And somehow we managed to pull it off. Is it last week or the week before? 25th of May.
I've seen it on social media. Brilliant, yeah.
One of the best days I've had. It was absolutely fantastic. All my family was there. I managed to get my brother, my nephews on the two brothers on the pitch, my nephew, brother-in-law, cousin, most of the girls that I'd grown up with playing football managed to come, and a few special guests. And then the guys that I got was like either agents or people, friends from school, or my coaches at the minute that have like kind of helped me in this new journey. So everyone that kind of stepped foot on the pitch for me meant something to me. So it was a really proud and special day, and we still haven't finished the sort of the fundraising thing yet. We've still got a few bits to do, but we've earned a bit of money as well for the charity, which is obviously the main important thing.
Excellent. And what's the website? What's the charity website and everything if people want to kind of check it out and donate
Yeah,
to that?
so Cardiac Risk in the Young is the charity. Obviously, I've got a Just Giving page that's actually on my Instagram profile pic if anyone does want to donate towards it. And there will be some auctions going live at some point, a few players' shirts, hopefully. So that would be a nice little plug.
Yeah.
And as for that, I think at any of those charities, the British Heart Foundation, Cardiac Risk in the Young, they all do the great work for people that are suffering with those sort of things. So either of them are great charities for people to get involved in.
We will drop a link in the bio of the podcast when it comes out for all this stuff as well. Obviously, Jay will share it with us, and we'll share that, and we'll support you in all those ventures off the field as well. Jade, as I say, you're such an amazing person, like such an amazing player, but such an amazing person. And I'm sure the work you're doing here will save lives. I'm sure it will help to save lives. And you know, sometimes I feel a little bit like earning my living out of kicking a ball around, or even worse, telling people to kick a ball around. For 25, sometimes envy people in the real world and the work that gets done. And I'm always very, very conscious of how amazing the voluntary sector is, and how people are out there doing, raising awareness or things like this. So if we can support in any way at the Pro Player, we will. Just let us know. It's been an unbelievable hour and a half, Jade. Like, to have you here with us sharing this time has been amazing. Personally, for me, it's great just to see you again and chat again. It's been a little while, obviously, but yeah, just a huge thank you from my end, and it's been amazing to get to speak to you again.
No, it's been great to see you too, Godfrey. I miss you, actually.
Thank you, buddy. Thank you. That does mean a lot. It's got to be getting on for, what, 8 or 9 years now since we worked together, but very special times. Very special times, very special team, very special moment. I think maybe after I've got all my kids out the house and kick the dog out, I might run back in and get that medal as well, you know. So maybe we share that in hand as well. But it's been great. It's been great, buddy. And I can't wait to see what you go and do next. Can't wait to go and support you in the future. And hopefully we'll have you back on at some point when we do some more stuff.
Appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, buddy.